This is Tom Rowe. You're listening to Turn on the News, 3103.9. You can go to newsroom.3103.9.org or 3103.9.org for more information about anything you hear here, including links to international radio art, radio news, media news, and more at 3103.9.org. Today on Turn on the News, this is the weekend edition, and we're going to look back at our week-long coverage of the low-power FM announcement from the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission in the United States, about how there might be hundreds or thousands of low-power FM stations coming to radio stations across the country soon. We'll look back at the pirate radio movement that led to the low-power FM law being approved, and we'll also look at the New York Times version of Silence. We'll hear Free Press's Media Minutes, and we'll hear new radio art from Diacroix, a Brooklyn band, and from the Radiator number 2 issue, the Love issue. That's all coming up on Turn on the News from 3103.9. This is Tom Rowe with Turn on the News, 3103.9's nightly look at radio art, radio news, media news, and more on 3103.9. You can go to newsroom.3103.9.org for more information about anything you hear here, including international links to radio art, radio news, media news, and more at newsroom.3103.9. Behind us tonight is Seth Price and his remix, Industrial Fist, remix of industrial music for 3103.9's Dispatch series. Antoine Champagne at Counterpunch reports on how Bashar al-Assad's Syrian regime censors the internet and retrieves logins and passwords of political opponents' emails or Facebook and Twitter pages. But the technology is innocuously named, quote, Deep Packet Inspection, unquote. DPI. When someone sends an email, a series of servers relays it to its destination. Each server sends the message on to the next, looking only at the recipient's address and not at the contents. The report implies the industry is growing. Quote, the recent WikiLeaks publication of numerous internal documents from these companies making the spying equipment shows that monitoring communication networks is, quote, a secret new industry spanning 25 countries. Traditional spy stories, intelligence agencies like MI5 bug the phones of one or two people of interest. In the last 10 years, systems of indiscriminate mass surveillance have become the norm. A little earlier, the Wall Street Journal published more than 200 marketing documents from 36 companies offering the U.S. anti-terrorist agency various surveillance and computer hacking tools, unquote, he reports. You can see that full story in Counterpunch. Sean M. Flame in Ars Technica is worried the imminent, quote, six strikes, unquote, copyright alert system. Major American internet service providers sending out, quote, strikes, unquote, to users accused of infringing on copyrights online violates antitrust law. Quote, 8 months ago, content owners and internet service providers agreed to the copyright alert system, a six-strike plan to reduce copyright infringement by internet users. Under the system, ISPs will soon send educational alerts, hijack browsers, and perhaps even slow or temporarily block the internet service and users accused of online infringement as identified by the content owners, unquote, he writes. Congress is the body that writes laws affecting interstate commerce. Antitrust, at least in part, offers protection against private companies doing the same. Recent reports indicate that the alert system, until now off to a slow start, will soon start affecting internet users. Once it does, regulators must look closely to make sure the system lives up to its main promise as an educational tool rather than a system of vigilante justice. You can read Sean's full column at Ars Technica. Paul Furst at Engineering Radio analyzes the Federal Communications Enforcement Federal Communications Commission's Enforcement Advisory Number 201202 about jamming devices for cell phones, GPS, and Wi-Fi, which specifies fines in excess of $100,000 per incident. The advisory said, quote, in recent days there have been various press reports about communities using cell phone jammers to create, quote, a quiet zone, unquote, on buses or trains. We caution consumers that it is against the law to use a cell or GPS jammer or any other type of device that blocks, jams, or interferes with authorized communications, as well as to import, advertise, sell, or ship such a device. The FCC Enforcement Bureau has a zero-tolerance policy in this area and will take aggressive action against violators. Thirst considers how most GPS jammers are being used as privacy protection devices. Quote, that set of people can range from truckers who don't want their bosses to know every aspect of their journey, citizens concerned about GPS tracking devices on their vehicles, or ordinary people who don't want the phone company tracking their every move via GPS-enabled cell phones, unquote, he writes. He also notes that there's plenty of interference for the FCC to worry about. IBOC to analog adjacent channels, broadband over power line, electrical noise on the medium wave band, illegal two-way radio stations on RPU frequencies, etc. Quote, of course there is no money in those issues, unquote, he observes. He notes that the FCC isn't going to catch many truckers going 70 miles per hour across interstate highways using small jamming devices. Quote, perhaps if the technology wasn't so pervasive and regularly abused by certain corporate and government entities, the desire to jam it wouldn't exist, unquote, he concludes. You can read that full story at Engineering Radio. In the background, Damien Katera, first Decompositional Duets from the Hogar Gallery performance, and perhaps later, if we get that much news, Decomposition, Tune In, Thirst and More, his remix of Thirst and More from Sonic Youth. That will be behind us. Henry Kenyon in Government Computer News reports that radio frequency interference in space is on the rise. Quote, Stuart Sanders, chairman and executive director of the Space Data Association, said March 13th during a panel on orbital radio frequency interference that issues at the Satellite 2012 conference in Washington that there are a number of reasons for this, and most are not related to intentional jamming. Where it used to take highly advanced nations with highly trained personnel to launch and maintain satellites, technological developments have lowered the entry requirements for space, which has increased the number of players in orbit, he said, unquote. Sanders notes there is some intentional jamming, quote, such as recent attempts to jam Eutelsat transmissions, quote, but this only represented about 5% of all detective interference, he said. From a commercial perspective, the vast majority of interference with satellite communications is created by human error, mostly from misaligned antennas and transmitters, unquote. Read the full story in Government Computer News. The link is at newsroom.free103.9.org. John Anderson at DIY Media reports that Cumulus Media, in a yearly filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, admits that no one cares about high-definition radio. The quote, on March 5th, 2009, we entered into an amendment to our agreement to reduce the number of planned conversions, extend the build-out schedule, and increase the license fees to be paid for each converted station. At this juncture, we cannot predict how successful our implementation of HD radio technology within our platform will be or how that implementation will affect our competitive position. Quote, to my knowledge, this is the first time that a backer of HD radio has been so forthright in a financial document about the tenuous nature of radio's digital transition, unquote, Anderson writes. Cumulus is the second largest broadcast company in the United States. They just bought Citadel Broadcasting. And Anderson does line up some other naysayers, too, for HD radio. Quote, Radio World reported in 2009 that an informal survey of executives in charge of capital expenditures at broadcast conglomerates found many planned to delay their digital conversion campaigns, unquote. Quote, Beasley Broadcast Group Chief Technology Officer Mike Cooney confirmed that his company was backing down on HD convergence in the small markets and putting money more in things that have a quicker return on investment for the capital money, end quote. And in 2009, Crown Broadcast reported that inquiries about HD compatible equipment were virtually non-existent. You can read that full story at DIYmedia.net. John Anderson over there, doing an always great job. Clara Leshen-Hoare for Scientific American via CNET reports that the agricultural industry is looking to shoot ultrasound at vegetables to remove pathogens. Quote, when applied to leafy greens, high-power ultrasound creates millions of tiny bubbles along a leaf surface. As they burst at a rate of 1,000 times a second, they provide high-energy shockwaves that can get into the leaf's nooks and crannies to dislodge pathogens, which are then whisked away in the sanitized wash. Earthbound is looking at citrus and parasitic acid-based sanitizers, both sanctioned for use with organic products, unquote. Leshen-Hoare writes, quote, mostly we're after E. coli, 0157H7 norovirus that causes winter vomiting, and we'll continue working with salmonella and listeria as well, says Robert Brackett, director of the Institute for Food Safety and Health, IFSH, at the Illinois Institute of Technology. The wine industry, Leshen-Hoare reports, has used ultrasound to clean oak barrels since 2006. From Wikipedia, ultrasound is a cyclic sound pressure with a frequency greater than the upper limit of human hearing. Ultrasound is thus not separated from normal audible sound based on differences in physical properties, only the fact that humans cannot hear it. Although this limit varies from person to person, it is approximately 20 kilohertz, 200,000 hertz, in healthy young adults. You can read that full story at CNET. Finally, Andrew Sullivan at The Dish rounds up opinions after the Mike Daisy This American Life incident this weekend. This American Life host Ira Glass announced Friday that Daisy lied to their fact-checkers and that they were retracting the episode of their radio show from January that included Daisy's work. On Saturday, This American Life devoted the entire episode to the incident. Some views around the internet. James Fallows assesses the damage done by Daisy. Daisy's, quote, Daisy's lying will hurt the Western press and international worker rights groups. When they get all huffy, Chinese nationalists love to present the Western press as being irrebuttably biased against Chinese achievements and ambitions and willing to pass along the most outrageous slanders about China without checking them for accuracy or even plausibility. A site called AnyCNN is a well-known outlet for such views. This is a constant nuisance when you try to write critical assessments. Worse, it gives ammo to those inside China who want to poo-poo complaints about safety, pollution, working conditions, and so on. Daisy is everything they warned against come to life. Felix Salmon compares the scandal to another one in the news right now. Quote, one of the reasons why Daisy's show has proved so popular, his This American Life episode was the most downloaded in the show's history, even more than The Squirrel Cop, is that it combined great storytelling with a feeling that this is happening now and we should do something about it. It's exactly the same formula used by Kony 2012, a project which is equally problematic. The fact is that the chief beneficiary of the success of Daisy's monologue has been Mike Daisy, much more than any group of factory workers or underground trades unionists in China. Similarly, the chief beneficiary of the success of Kony 2012 has been Invisible Children, a U.S. nonprofit which spends its money mostly on making movies. Jack Schaefer sizes up Fabulous. Quote, I have my theory. One, they lie because they don't have the time or talent to tell the truth. Two, they lie because they think they can get away with it. And three, they lie because they have no respect for the audience they claim to want to enlighten. That would be the ideal subject for a one-man theatrical performance, unquote. You can read that full story at Andrew Sullivan's excellent The Dish. And we're going to go to Washington, D.C. today for the FCC's open meeting, March 21st. There were two items on the agenda. The FCC was initiating a rulemaking to promote interoperability in the lower 700 megahertz band. And the FCC was proposing 400 megahertz of additional spectrum for mobile broadband. First, let's go to the FCC's press release. The Federal Communications Commission today issued a notice of proposed rulemaking to promote interoperability and encourage the efficient use of spectrum in the commercial lower 700 megahertz band, 698 through 746 megahertz. The rulemaking is designed primarily to examine the interference concerns should the lower 700 megahertz band utilize a single band class for devices operating across the lower 700 megahertz ABC blocks. In the NPRM, the notice for proposed rulemaking, the FCC seeks comment on a range of technical and operational factors regarding the use of unified band class on customers of lower 700 megahertz B and C block licensees. The NPRM focuses on two interference concerns that can result with use of a single band class. One, reverse intermodulation interference from adjacent DTV Channel 51 operations, and two, blocking interference from neighboring high-powered operations in the lower 700 megahertz E block. To properly evaluate the interference concerns, the FCC requests comment on measurements and quantitative analysis regarding the magnitude and extent of the interference risk from adjacent Channel 51 and lower 700 megahertz E-block transmissions, the availability of effective interference mitigation measures, relative performance of devices using a single-band class, and costs of implementing interoperability. Free Press Policy Director Matt Wood weighed in on the FCC's open meeting today with this statement. Quote, "We hope and trust that the process begun today will lead to sensible interoperability requirements for the lower 700 megahertz band and beyond. Such rules could address any legitimate technical issues, but should still prevent AT&T and Verizon from dividing this prime mobile broadband spectrum into exclusive technological enclaves. Waiting for the wireless industry to solve this problem on its own seems a vain exercise when we have already been waiting 4 years for such solutions, and none have been forthcoming from these duopoly providers. When U.S. consumers lined up for new 4G LTE-enabled iPads last week, they faced a familiar if unwelcome choice among carriers. That doesn't mean choosing the wireless provider that offers the best service in the customer's view, but literally just picking the carrier on whose network a device will even function. Manufacturers like Apple produce two incompatible versions of the same product for the U.S. market, an AT&T-only iPad and a Verizon-only iPad, and that have different types of radios built into them. Unwilling to bank solely on their ability to lock down customers and handsets by means of exclusive contracts, AT&T and Verizon have used their market clout to hardwire exclusivity into the devices. A large part of LTE's promise was the unification of technical standards. Those standards should give consumers the chance to switch providers without discarding their old phones or tablets, and give more carriers the chance to compete by offering cutting-edge devices. That has started to pay off in places like Canada, where large carriers all use the same type of spectrum and compatible radios for iPads and their other LTE offerings. The promise can pay dividends here, too, so long as the commission finishes the work it starts today." And to go with this, too, we have some recorded comments from the meeting today from the since we gave you the free press take on it. Here's the Republican Robert McDowell on the commission, the FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell, and his opinion on these issues today.
Commissioner McDowell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And all this beats having to fill out my second chance bracket, let me tell you that much. I'm voting today to approve today's notice of proposed rulemaking regarding interoperable communications in the lower 700 megahertz band. I thank all the interested parties for sharing their insights and marketplace experiences on this topic. And I'm grateful to the chairman for his willingness to accept edits to create a more dispassionate analysis and thereby allow for more analytical comment. And especially for the generous comment time frame. A lot of these issues are highly technical in nature, and the three of us are liberal arts majors, so we're going to need that extra time to understand all those technicalities. Although I support today's actions, I hope that all interested parties will come to the negotiating table and work in good faith to develop their own solution. Government mandates should be a last resort. That maxim is especially relevant here because minimal regulation in the wireless sector has created an environment that has maximized opportunities for investment, innovation, competition, and job creation. Before disrupting this fruitful environment with new government mandates, all stakeholders, including industry and consumers, should work as hard as they can to produce a private sector solution. An independently created interoperability framework stands far better chance of success than would a top-down government regulation. In other words, the private sector is better at this than we are. In fact, we might not be here today were it not for earlier mandates handed down in July 2007, from which I dissented.
Commissioner McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, of course, as we all know, Americans are consuming more of the airwaves than ever before through powerful new mobile broadband devices. Our appetite for spectrum seems insatiable. Today, the FCC takes a small but important step towards satisfying that hunger. With mobile broadband in mind, since my arrival at the Commission, I've advocated for more flexible use standards when adopting spectrum policy. The Commission has a checkered past of micromanaging spectrum use, only to find years later that technical innovation and market demands have evolved past the government's myopic view. Exploring ways to allow for dynamic uses of valuable frequencies while preventing harmful interference to other licensees and users is a laudable goal. Our notice of proposed rulemaking liberating the 2 gigahertz band, rebranding it today as AWS-4, for possible terrestrial broadband use is a step in the right direction. I commend Chairman Jenikowski for bringing forward this comprehensive deregulatory and broadly applicable proposal. But it didn't stop there. He has also put forth today's notice of inquiry on a proposed, quote, 2 gigahertz extension band concept, end quote. Now, that's not quite as catchy as AWS-4, so we'll work on the branding of that name. But anyway, but that incorporates an idea from the National Telecommunications and Information Administration to reallocate 1695 to 1710 megahertz from federal to commercial use. I look forward to learning from all interested parties on these timely proposals. And again, I thank the tireless Wireless Telecommunications Bureau, as well as the International Bureau, and as well as our friends at NTIA for all of your thoughtful and creative work on this.
You are tuned in to Turn on the News, 3.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, and more. It's Muslim Gaz behind us tonight with Uzi Mahood, 12-inch. And a couple of Free 103.9 co-conspirator kind of related events coming up in New York this summer. In conjunction with the exhibition Transmittal, a transmission art exhibition in Greene County, New York, June 2nd. This workshop, June 2nd, will teach participants to unlock new sonic dimensions in an everyday object, an FM radio receiver. The workshop's called Build Your Own Radio Synthesizer Workshop. Participants will learn the basics of electronics hacking through circuit bending from New York-based artist Philip Stearns. Circuit bending is the art of creative short circuit where the electronics of a device are exposed and rewired to produce new sounds and tones. No prior electronics knowledge is required. You'll learn how to work with wires, solder, install switches and knobs. When you're finished, you'll have your own unique battery-powered radio synthesizer. Go to newsroom.free103.9.org for more information, contact information, and 3103.9.org. Also this summer, in nearby, in Hudson, New York, across the Hudson River from workshop's in Catskill, New York. I'm sorry, I didn't say that. There's an oral history workshop this summer, Oral History Intensive, from oral historian Suzanne Snyder, who is a writer and oral historian who has worked as an interviewer for Columbia University's Center for Oral History, New York Academy of Medicine, HBO Productions, the Newton Creek Community Health and Harms Narrative Project, the Prison Public Memory Project, among others. Her oral history projects have touched upon subjects including public health, disappearing labor forces, rehabilitative medicine, and feminist presses. She's giving an intensive workshop July 13th through 22nd. In Hudson, New York. Again, you can go to newsroom.free103.9.org for more information. You can also go to freepress.net/resources/event listing for all sorts of media events, including the Free Press National Conference for Media Reform. That's coming up April 5th through April 7th in Denver, Colorado. There's a global censorship conference at Yale Law School March 30th through April 1st. Again, you can go to the Free Press website for links. Nonprofit technology conference is April 3rd through 5th in San Francisco. Thank you. scanner underneath us from his time-lapse CD. Time for tonight's headlines, radio headlines. Tom Cheridar at VentureBeat explains the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing Wednesday, March 21st, where executives from Verizon and Comcast claimed consumers would benefit from the approval of a multi-billion dollar spectrum deal between the largest U.S. carrier and the country's biggest cable television providers. Cheridar writes, quote, "Last year, Verizon agreed to spend $3.6 billion to obtain a portion of spectrum currently owned by Spectrum Co., a joint venture that consists of Comcast, Time Warner Cable, Bright House Networks, and Cox Communications. That deal is currently under investigation by antitrust regulators due to concerns that it could stifle competition and impact consumers negatively. If approved, it would mean that the majority of the wireless spectrum in the United States, which is used to transmit data via cell phones, GPS devices, radios, broadcast TV stations, and more, would belong to only two companies, Verizon and AT&T. And because this is the only nationwide portion of the spectrum available for the next several years, if not longer, it also means there likely won't be many new companies emerging as competitors in the wireless market," unquote. Senator Al Franken wondered about it. He said, "This deal seems to be to completely abandon the goals of the Telecom Act, the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Verizon Executive Vice President Randall Milch explained that, quote, his company would dutifully spend billions of dollars to build out Spectrum Co.'s spectrum into a viable wireless network. This, in turn, would generate more money for Verizon by improving their overall wireless network and charging customers to use it," unquote, Cheridar writes. You can read the full story at VentureBeat. And that link is at newsroom.free103.9.org. Andy Vogue in the Denver Post reports that the Dish Network wants to use spectrum it purchased to provide mobile broadband for smartphones and is asking the Federal Communications Commission to drop a condition that handsets using the new spectrum be able to communicate with both satellites and ground-based cellular towers. Quote, "While acknowledging that the FCC rulemaking can take close to a year, Dish is hoping for an expedited process because of the nation's looming spectrum crunch," unquote, Vogue wrote in the company's hometown newspaper. Dish Network is based in Colorado. And there's a full story in the Denver Post. NOAA's got space weather forecasts for solar and geomagnetic activity from March 19th through April 14th. Solar activity is expected to remain at low levels March 19th through 26th, or March 27th, and then March 28th. They're expected to return in two regions. Even though these regions are on the far side of the solar disk, imagery supports that they are still active in producing CMEs. An increase in to low to moderate levels is expected March 28th to April 11th as both regions populate the front side of the solar disk. A return to predominantly low levels is expected to prevail for the remainder of the forecast period. You can see that complete forecast at newsroom.free103.9.org and a link to NOAA's space weather. Free Speech Radio News has another report about what we've been talking about all week, the Local Community Radio Act and Low Power FM. We've been talking about on Turn on the News all week. Earlier this week, the Federal Communications Commission announced a decision to implement the key provisions of the Local Community Radio Act. And Free Speech Radio News talks to Brandy Doyle from Prometheus Radio Project about the possibility of thousands of new low-power FM stations across the country.
The Federal Communications Commission approved a rule this week that will boost the number of low-power radio stations around the country. The decision implements a key provision of the Local Community Radio Act, a law Congress approved in 2010 that removed restrictions on creating more low-power local stations. It took about 10 years of community advocacy to pass the bill, which the corporate broadcast lobby opposed. Monday's decision affects thousands of applications for translators, which repeat programming from large stations usually outside of the community, sometimes far away. Some media corporations apply for dozens of translators to rebroadcast their material, decreasing the diversity of voices on the airwaves. Brandy Doyle is with the Prometheus Radio Project, a group that pushed for passage of the Local Community Radio Act. She said this vote shifts the balance of who dominates the national airwaves.
If the FCC hadn't dismissed all of these applications, then translators would have filled up all the available frequencies that could have gone to local community groups. And so they dismissed them in order to make room for new low-power FM, LPFM stations that can be used for local groups who want to play local news and information, who want to have local music and artists on, and people can use their own airwaves for news that's relevant to their communities.
Following this week's announcement, locally based nonprofit organizations can apply starting this fall to create radio stations that will broadcast 3 to 5 miles in any direction. Doyle says this will especially help outreach and education in marginalized communities.
Consolidation in commercial media ownership has really left most communities with fewer and fewer options for news of any kind, much less a diversity of viewpoints in the news. And it certainly doesn't meet the needs of people who speak languages other than English, for working people, for women. So the chance for us to tell our own stories and be able to use local airwaves for local needs is really important, and not just in getting informed, but in developing solutions to problems on the ground.
Many immigrant rights groups have expressed interest in creating radio stations to spread information and better mobilize their urban communities, including Puente in Arizona, which has been organizing against the anti-immigrant law SB 1070, and the Somali American community in Minneapolis.
We'll be back in a second with Media Minutes from Free Press.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tavey. Verizon has joined forces with a cadre of cable companies, including Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Cox, in a controversial deal that would divide up the broadband market. Verizon is vying to buy $3.6 billion in unused spectrum from the cable companies to expand its own network. Giving up the spectrum means cable companies will back away from investing in the wireless market. In return, Verizon has agreed to lay off of cable companies' turf by not building out residential broadband fiber networks. Josh Levy, the Internet Campaign Director for Free Press, said the companies should be rivals, but instead are helping each other corner their respective markets.
Verizon won't compete with the cable companies anymore, and the cable companies won't compete with Verizon anymore. It's kind of like the five families of The Godfather getting together and dividing up territory. This is pretty much what Verizon and these cable companies have done.
In addition, the companies have proposed a cross-marketing agreement to sell each other's services to their customers, further solidifying their dominance. Verizon is already the leading wireless provider in the country. Levy said the deal is bad news for the public because it would stifle competition.
So if you live in a community that has one cable broadband provider and you've been hoping that a company like Verizon would come in and build a high-speed fiber optic network, your hopes are going to be dashed. It's not going to do that anymore. You are going to be stuck with that cable provider. And that cable provider might not be willing to build out into underserved areas. It might not be willing to provide prices that are affordable for all residents. And so a lot of people who have been stuck with inadequate access or no access are still going to be stuck.
The deal has already raised eyebrows in Congress. The Senate Antitrust Subcommittee has held a hearing this week to discuss the deal. And the Federal Communications Commission asked the companies to submit further details on the arrangement. Levy said public outrage is growing against the deal.
Big broadband companies like Verizon, like AT&T in the past, rather than try to innovate and serve customers through better service and better pricing, instead make these power grabs. They can own even more of the market, charge us even more, and get around the need to provide better service and greater choice.
To learn more, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index says that crackdown was the word of the year in 2011. Never have journalists, through their reporting, vexed the enemies of freedom so much. Never have acts of censorship and physical attacks on journalists seemed so numerous. With the warmer weather, will likely come more Occupy protests and more journalists trying to get the story. But this spring, any surge in abusive tactics against journalists will be met with a renewed effort to protect the First Amendment and support the rights of both mainstream and citizen journalists to report on the protests. Free Press created an audio piece as a message from our members to journalists.
I'm Josh Stearns, Journalism and Public Media Campaign Director at Free Press. When we asked our members to stand with the nearly 70 journalists who've been arrested covering Occupy Wall Street protests, the response was profound. More than 40,000 people wrote letters and called their mayors to demand that they uphold the First Amendment. What follows are just a few of the comments our members sent in.
Friends in the journalist community, thank you for your commitment to getting the story, the truth, as close as possible and bringing it to us, the public. I'm shocked that you are victims of this violation of your rights by those who are willing to violate our laws and erode our Constitution.
Please keep doing what you're doing. We all know the arrests are wrong, but your work is so important to democracy. We can't have it without you.
Freedom of the press is one of the first and most important notions of the founding of our country. It is not possible to have democracy without it. And as in earlier years, the press extends to anyone reporting, not just those employed by the major outlets.
Do not be discouraged by the outrageous actions of politicians who cannot stand the heat and violate our First Amendment rights. Americans are watching, and we are standing behind you because we know that our freedom depends on your accurate reporting.
I was born into journalism. My father and uncle owned newspapers all their lives. I'm livid at the freewheeling of law enforcement that tramples over the rights of the people by arresting journalists. That supposedly only happens in countries without a constitution like ours.
Your courage in reporting, regardless of the consequences, is amazing. Thank you for doing your job. Now it's our turn to try to help you obtain your freedom. Stay strong.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
All right, this is Tom Rowe with Turn on the News, and tonight we're going to look at the LPFM, low power FM, and what happens at the federal communications commission has just announced. Radio Inc. magazine has the details of the Federal Communications Commission's two orders to implement the Local Community Radio Act. The FCC release says, quote, "The items help promote community radio through the licensing of low-power FM, LPFM, and FM translator stations, advancing the Local Community Radio Act and Commission goal of fostering localism and diversity in the radio landscape," unquote. And others weighed in, quote, "We are pleased that the FCC has taken such a careful approach to preserving channels for community radio," unquote, said Brandy Doyle, policy director for the Prometheus Radio Project, a Philadelphia-based lobbying group for community radio. Quote, "And we're particularly glad that the FCC has taken our recommendation to ensure that the frequencies set aside are in populated areas where they are needed. This will make a big difference in San Antonio, Sacramento, and 12 other mid-sized markets where stations too far from the city would have reached only tumbleweeds or farmland," unquote. So we'll have lots more details about this throughout the course of the show. But let's get a little overview from Vanessa Graber from Prometheus Radio Project. She was on WGXC recently, and here's an excerpt of an interview, and she explained the process that led to where we are today.
Yeah, so I will give you a little bit of history for all the listeners out there that maybe might not know about the Local Community Radio Act and how it's affected the rulemaking at the FCC. In 2000, that was the first time the FCC licensed low-power FM stations, and about 860 or so licenses were given out. After that, the Radio Preservation Act was passed, and that essentially limited the FCC from being able to license any more low-power stations. As a result of that act, which was mainly passed by big broadcasters and their lobby group, the National Association of Broadcasters, because they claimed that these little low-power stations interfered with their signal. So the FCC commissioned a study, about $2 million, called a MITRE study, and they concluded that there were no real interference issues with these LPFM. So the road was sort of cleared for the FCC to license more stations. But we needed to pass new legislation to repeal the Radio Preservation Act, and it took us 10 years to do that. And finally, in 2010, in January of last year, Obama signed the Local Community Radio Act into law, which it repeals the Radio Preservation Act and mandates the FCC to expand the low-power FM radio program. And it also allows stations to be on the third adjacent channel. So essentially, stations are allowed to be spaced closer together. And in order to expand the LPFM program, the FCC had to resolve the translator issue. Translators are devices that repeat the signal of a larger station. So many NPR stations, for example, will rebroadcast their content using a translator. And 2,000 of these applications were filed, and the FCC froze them as a result of their advocacy. That is, it didn't process them until we figured out the LPFM issue. Now that we have the Local Community Radio Act, they're able to make a decision on what they're going to do with those translator applications. And the Prometheus Radio Project, along with a coalition of other organizations and grassroots organizers, has petitioned the FCC during the last commenting period, which was in the fall, to leave those spaces on the spectrum open for LPFM rather than translators. So they're expected to announce their decision on March 21st.
So here we are. And that all doesn't sound very controversial, but actually it was at one time. Not in the too distant past. We'll go back to, say, the early 1990s. And at that point, there was a weird catch-22 with Federal Communications Commission's law. You could be a big, giant station and broadcast thousands and thousands and thousands of watts and cost a lot of money to get on the air. But you couldn't be a little station. There were a few grandfathered in 10-watt educational stations, mostly at colleges and high schools, but there were no regulations to apply for a 100-watt station or a small station like that to reach just a highly concentrated population area where there was certainly space on the dial for such. And to prove that, thousands and thousands of folks went on the air in acts of civil disobedience during the 90s to show that there was space on the dial and there was community interest in broadcasting and filling in those gaps on the dial that were clearly available. As far back as 1998, at a National Association of Broadcasters conference, we have some audio of someone speaking about the possible engineering ways of getting more voices on the air.
There is, of course, no question that these stations are violating the law. I think one of the traditional methods of challenging a law is to violate the law and take it to court. And that appears to be what Mr. Dunifer has done. I have not heard exactly how the FCC has answered the constitutional questions, other than saying the Supreme Court has said through the years that there is no constitutional right to turn on a transmitter. It does appear that there could, in the spectrum allocation process, be a couple of channels set aside for unlicensed use with FCC-approved transmitters on a non-interfering basis, sort of an expansion of Part 15. Another area is this, as Mr. Ruck mentioned, the elimination of Class D stations and the lack of local origination on FM translators. And I'm wondering if these FCC prohibitions are the least restrictive method of serving a legitimate government interest, which I think is the First Amendment question Mr. Dunifer is pushing.
Mr. Dunifer, that the speaker was referring to, is Stephen Dunifer. He started Free Radio Berkeley, a pirate radio station, micro radio station, he soon started calling it. In the early 1990s, he was upset about the mainstream media's lack of coverage of the first Gulf War and set up his own broadcast station in Berkeley and then began making small, cheap kits for building transmitters and making them available around the world. And several thousand micro radio stations soon sprung up in his wake. He was sort of the Johnny Appleseed of the movement, which became more and more political and was being waged not just in the civil disobedience front, but Mr. Dunifer won an 18-month stay that was allowed to broadcast on the air from Judge Claudia Wilkin in 1997, which emboldened even more micro-radio advocates across the country to take to the airwaves. It's Mojo Nixon in the background. All these stations were committing civil disobedience, and then the court started ruling in their favor, and the media began painting very positive features about stations that when the commercial station in town stopped airing the town meeting, the pirate radio station would air it. Or the station when there was a flood was the only station in town that was live and local, not the commercial stations, was the pirate station that you could call, and the mayor was on the line explaining what to do in San Marcos, Texas. So this was happening all over the country, and then pop stars like Mojo Nixon and John Hyatt start writing songs in favor of these kind of actions, and Stephen Dunifer eventually created some demands. We're having lots of fun. Sing!
I am 8 years old. We basically have called for a mass micropower turn-on to occur on the first anniversary of the LPFM ruling, which is January 20th, if I remember correctly, by the Federal Communications Commission. So we're basically now putting out an official call as a micropower action coalition for mass turn-on of micropower stations on January 20th. And we will do a special web feed that we hope everyone across the country will carry so we can show our power as a, at the very least, a national, if not international network of micropower stations. And to that end, and consistent with the principle that the right to communicate is a human right, and that intervention in the exercise of this right by any entity, government, corporate, otherwise, is untenable, we also are making the following demands as the Micropower Action Coalition. These demands are, first demand is a demand of amnesty for all micro broadcasters so that all of them are eligible to apply for an LPM license if they so choose to do so. Second demand is to set aside TV Channel 6 at the bottom of the FM band as expanded FM coverage and assign that those three new channels to a micropower service only. Third demand is to eliminate the ban against second adjacent channel spacing under the current LPFM. We demand that any further encroachment on the analog FM band by digital broadcasting be immediately stopped, and that digital broadcasting should follow the European standard of ERECA and occur in a totally different band of the spectrum, and the analog FM broadcast band be left alone as is. Next demand is to drop ownership caps and reduce them to pre-96 Telecommunications Act levels. To prohibit any further sales of spectrum by either licensees or the FCC. We also demand free airtime for all political candidates and an end to the relationship that allows broadcasters to fulfill certain obligations by broadcasting messages or programs that promote a particular viewpoint or policy of the federal government. Next, we also demand an end to U.S. government-sponsored, either directly or indirectly, broadcast directed against Cuba. And finally, we demand that the sovereign rights of Native indigenous peoples to freely broadcast on their lands without government sanction or control.
So I think he got 1.5 of his demands met by the Federal Communications Commission yesterday. That was Stephen Dunifer from Free Radio Berkeley, a micro radio station from the mid-90s till now, and who's been a long advocate for people having access to their own airwaves. This is John Hyatt with Pirate Radio behind us. So Mr. Dunifer there was demanding a set of demands after the federal government had already caved in to some extent to the civil disobedience of the pirate radio stations across the country and was considering and had considered a first early version of low-power FM legalization. It was a tough fight, and it sounds like an easy to understand situation. I'll explain. The demands that he named that he won were the allowing low-power FM on second adjacent frequencies. Previously, they were only allowed on third adjacent frequencies, which means that if you're broadcasting on, say, 90.7 FM, the first adjacent frequency is 90.5, and nobody's supposed to be on that. The second adjacent is 90.3. That's the second adjacent frequency. And 90.7, a full-power station, 90.3, a full-power station can coexist, but an LPFM, a tiny 10-watt or 100-watt station, is not allowed to be that close to a big station. It has to be three away. This ruling today eliminates that, and means that the low power stations, obviously, that don't interfere with the big stations, obviously can be as close together, which will allow more stations. So one of Mr. Dunifer's demands there, and the last thing he said was about indigenous people. There is something in the ruling, and I'll try to dig it out here, that addresses that indigenous Native Americans can apply for these low power FM stations for their on their land. So he may have gotten two demands. I'll look at it more closely. This is Tom Rowe with Turn on the News, and we have a special edition tonight just looking at the Federal Communications Commission's decision announced yesterday about low-power FM and their expected window for folks to apply for apply to get their own low-power FM station later this year. We were explaining the process that we got to. And so the first step in about 2000, the Congress passed the first local community radio act, and it had that second adjacent frequency law because the National Association of Broadcasters, they created all sorts of lies about low-power FM and saying that it was going to interfere with big giant stations. These tiny, tiny stations were going to interfere with big giant stations. That was their big, big argument. This is the CD that they sent to senators and House of Representatives across the country explaining what the interference would sound like if low-power FM stations would be allowed on the air. This is what low-power FM stations would be allowed if they were allowed to go on the air, which is, you know, currently the case. This is what the radio dial was going to sound like. The National Broadcasters sent this CD to senators and congressmen back in the year 2000.
This is Chuck Jackson. I'm an electrical engineer with my own firm, JTC. I have experience at the FCC and have worked for more than 30 years in the electronics and communications industry. I earned my PhD in electrical engineering at MIT. I was retained by the NAB to do an independent analysis of the four studies of FM receiver performance that were before the FCC as part of the low-power FM rulemaking. I prepared this CD at the NAB's request. The CD demonstrates the technical standards the FCC used in its recent rulemaking on low-power FM stations. Specifically, the CD illustrates the impact of the changes in the existing interference protection standard that radio listeners currently enjoy. We digitally recorded the over-the-air radio signals of five popular stations in the Washington area. We then electronically added the types of interference that we project would be heard by listeners if new LPFM stations are licensed in this market. The levels of interference that we have added have been deemed by the Commission in its report and order to be acceptable to consumers. Said another way, the Commission feels that consumers would judge these modified radio station signals to be, quote, adequate, unquote, after the addition of these new interference levels. The interference we use is technically called crosstalk. In practical terms, crosstalk means you can hear the audio from another station in the background of the desired station. The first two levels of impairment or interference that we demonstrate are levels that the FCC's Office of Engineering and Technology classified as acceptable to listeners. The third and most extreme example of interference was deemed acceptable by the National Lawyers Guild study, a study on which the FCC relied in its final report and order. Here is a brief cut from WAMU, a public broadcasting affiliate in Washington, D.C., run by American University. This was recorded off-air using a good-quality consumer radio and illustrates the sound quality currently enjoyed by its
Hello,
listeners.
This is Cleo, and you're listening
Complete
to
listing
WGXC
of open jams is on the hotline. The hotline
FM
is open
Acre.
Anytime you call 202-885-1234 or 1-800-525-8338, or you could visit our homepage at www.wamu.org.
Here is the radio station you just heard, but now with crosstalk at the level that would push performance of a Sony Walkman to the FCC's 1% test level. This 1% level is substantially better than the level the FCC deems the limit of consumer acceptance. The FCC says that this is the level of interference at which, quote, most listeners would not be able to perceive any degradation. See if you agree.
Complete listing of open jams is on the hotline. The hotline is open anytime you call 202-885-1234 or 1-800-525-8338, or you can visit our homepage at www.wamu.org.
So that was later revealed to be a complete hoax and lies from the National Association of Broadcasters. And anyone who's listened to the dial since low-power FM has been in effect knows that that's not what radio stations sound like, and that this claim that tiny 10 or 100-watt stations are going to affect 50,000-watt stations like that is amazingly surreal. So we'll go to the real engineers and see what yesterday's announcement from the Federal Communication Commission means. Paul Thurst at Engineering Radio says the announcement, the FCC has more or less stuck with its plan to keep a minimum number of LPFM channels available in the top 150 markets. This also includes a 50 application limit for the country and no more than one application per market per applicant. Where conflicts occur, translator applicants get the chance to demonstrate how their application would not preclude LPFM opportunities, unquote. Quote, modifies eventually eliminates the May 1st, 2009 cutout date for cross-service AM to FM translators. Quote, a new LPFM allocations are established under the criteria of disregarding the third adjacent channel contours. We mentioned that before. FCC added, quote, more stringent requirements for local programming and ownership, especially as a determining factor for mutual LPFM applications. Quote, allows LPFM stations to own translators, unquote. Quote, new class of LPFM is established, the LP250. 250-watt LPFM stations are designed mainly for areas outside of top 50 markets or for previously licensed LP100 stations that want to upgrade, provided the minimum separation contours are met with existing stations, unquote. So that's one radio engineer, licensed radio engineer's opinion of this week's announcement from the Federal Communication about new applications will be accepted soon for low-power stations across the country. Paul Rimsmandale at Radio Survivor weighs in with all sorts of interesting observations on this. Quote, one of the main challenges facing the FCC is the backlog of 6,500 applications for FM translator repeater stations. Because of the relaxed spacing requirements enacted by the Local Community Radio Act, many of these translator applications would compete for spaces on the dial that would otherwise be suitable for new low-power FM community stations. While the Commission will proceed with reviewing these translator applications before accepting new LPFM apps, in its fourth order report and order, the Commission sets forth procedures to ensure that frequencies appropriate for LPFM stations remain, especially in densely populated urban areas that are underserved by existing broadcast media. The Commission explicitly acknowledges that the next licensing window for LPFM, quote, presents a critical and indeed possibly a last opportunity to nurture and promote a community radio service that can respond to unmet listener needs and underserved communities in many urban areas, unquote. At the same time, the FCC finds that since translator stations have more flexible licensing standards than the next LPFM licensing round, quote, will have only a modest impact on licensing opportunities for future translator stations, unquote. Therefore, the Commission is favoring the licensing of LPFM stations because they are, quote, uniquely positioned to meet local needs, particularly in areas of higher population density where LPFM service is practical and sustainable. However, in a nod to the National Association of Broadcasters, the FCC also agrees to give current translator applicants in these so-called spectrum-limited markets the opportunity to demonstrate that their applications would not preclude any LPFM opportunities if granted. The Commission will allow these applicants one opportunity to make minor changes to their applications in order to meet this requirement. From Radio Inc., their version of the details of the fourth report and order sets forth a revised spectrum availability analysis that better identifies and protects areas with significant populations where LPFM service is more practical and sustainable. It gives translator applicants proposing to serve spectrum-limited areas an ability to demonstrate that their applications, if granted, would not preclude certain identified LPFM opportunities. It adopts a national cap of 50 applications and a market-based cap of one application per applicant per market for the most spectrum-limited markets, minimizing the potential for speculative licensing conduct, and modifies the May 1st, 2009 date restriction to allow pending FM translator applications that are subsequently granted to be used cross-service translators. Rimsdale at Radio Survivor also says, quote, a suggestion that is likely to draw criticism from many LPFM advocates is one to permit the cross-ownership of an LPFM station with translator stations. This proposal seems like the Commission's attempt to throw a bone to the large religious broadcasters who rely on large chains of translator stations to rebroadcast the programming of a main full-power station in their order to create a nationwide network on the cheap. These broadcasters are likely to be unhappy with the FCC's decision to give LPFM stations priority, and so it seems that this is an attempt to mollify them by letting them get into the LPFM game and potentially reclaim some of their lost frequencies, or quote lost. The adoption of such a rule would have a significant effect on competition for LPFM licenses, since these non-commercial religious translators are often applied for by local groups that have no formal connections to the broadcaster that originates the signal being rebroadcast. If LPFM translator cross-ownership were permitted, there would be a sudden influx of dozens, if not hundreds, of applicants that would otherwise be ineligible for an LPFM license. My concern would be about these groups' intention and the ability to actually produce and broadcast locally originated programming, since translators explicitly do not air such programs. That's why translators are attracted to these groups, making the cost and complication for owning and operating them relatively minimal for local groups. However, an LPFM with 8 or more hours of local programming a day is much more involved endeavor, and these same groups may not actually be able to maintain if they even have a real intention to do so in the first place. But of course, the Commission will be accepting public comments on these proposals, and I'm certain that LPFM advocates, the broadcast industry, NPR, and religious broadcasters won't hesitate to weigh in. A 5-day window for LPFM applications is expected to be announced for September or October. Go to newsroom.free103.9.org for more information about all of this. There's links to the Radio Inc. story, the Radio Survivor story, and the Radio Engineering blog item, too, and more at newsroom.free103.9.org. And we're going to go... we've been telling you all week the big story here at Turn on the News has been the FCC's announcement about low-power FM and the resolution they've come to about the translator issue and trying to explain what the translator issue means. A translator is a station that's not licensed to originate programming, but it picks up programming from another main studio and relays it to a further, more remote area, usually where there's a population center. But there's been a lot of abuse with stations buying up translators all over the country and stringing them together and, in effect, creating a large network and getting around certain rules. So the FCC's been trying to clear it up, and the folks at the Prometheus Radio Project created this video trying to explain the translator issue. And the good news is that the FCC announcement this week, most of the things that Prometheus talks about are kind of satisfied and addressed. So here's that recording.
Local community radio is coming to cities and towns across the country. Maybe. This January, the Local Community Radio Act was signed into a law, which means that thousands of communities will have their first chance at community radio. The new law expands low-power FM radio, also known as LPFM, to cities and towns across the United States. LPFMs are small, non-commercial radio stations that are locally run, but there's a couple of loose ends we need to tie up at the FCC before people just like you get their hands on the radio.
Right now, the FCC is trying to figure out how to deal with thousands of translator applications that have been pending for years.
Translators are small stations, under 250 watts, that repeat what's on another station. Translators were originally intended to allow full-power stations to reach more people in their area. For example, a station in a mountainous area might require a translator to reach listeners whose reception is blocked by the landscape.
Space for radio stations is limited. In 2003, the FCC let people apply for translators, and over 12,000 applications were filed. Many were from just a few applicants who were looking either to sell the translators or to create large national networks that blanket the country and repeat the same content from a single station.
These translator applications threaten to use up all the space available for low-power FM stations, especially in cities where the FM dial is already crowded. Thanks to a public outcry and a petition filed by Prometheus, the FCC froze the process to save spaces for community radio. Over 6,000 translator applications are waiting to be processed today. If the FCC let them all through, most big cities and small towns would lose their chance at community radio forever.
But the future might not be so bleak. The Local Community Radio Act requires the FCC to make sure that low-power radio makes its way into communities all over the country. The law requires the FCC to license new stations based on the needs of local communities.
To do it, the FCC needs to figure out a set of rules that balance between translators and opportunities for new low-power stations.
The FCC took a close look at the top 150 radio markets and proposed a minimum amount of LPFM stations based on the size of the market. If there is not enough room, the FCC will dismiss all of the translator applications in that city. This is called the LPFM floor. Let's look at Atlanta. In that city, the FCC determined that there is potentially room for 4 low-power stations.
They drew a 30 by 30 grid over the center of every market and looked for where there might be enough spaces for a low-power FM station. This revealed potential LPFM channels. Four channels are available, but the FCC set their floor at 8. Now, that does not mean that there's going to be room for 8 stations, but it does mean that 4 stations is less than what the FCC would like to see in that size market. If the floor is not met, then those pending translator applications are dismissed. Goodbye.
But we need to make sure that the floors for low-power radio are high enough for all of our voices to be heard.
In fact, the FCC is asking the public to comment on the plan, and we have 30 days to let them know why cities and towns across the country would benefit from getting a low-power FM radio station.
That was a Prometheus video from a couple years ago, and this week, just yesterday, Brandy Doyle had this statement. We're particularly glad that the FCC has taken our recommendation to ensure that the frequencies set aside are in populated areas where they are needed. This will make a big difference in San Antonio, Sacramento, and 12 other mid-sized markets where stations too far from the city would have reached only tumbleweeds or farmland. Go to newsroom.free103.9.org for more explanation about low-power FM, translator stations, and more. And more about radio art, radio news, media art, media news, and more at newsroom.free103.9.org and free103.9.org. You're listening to Transmission Arts on free103.9. Kim Tingley asks, is silence going extinct, in a cover story in the New York Times Magazine. At Alaska's Denali National Park and Preserve, Tingley walks deep into the tundra, almost inside the Arctic Circle. Quote, our destination was a ridge above Hines Creek, where David, the park's physical science technician, Beth Chackle, planned to assemble a station to collect a month's worth of continuous acoustic data documenting an intangible, invisible, and increasingly endangered resource, natural sound. Our mission was not only to trap the ephemeral, but also to experience it ourselves, which at the moment was impossible for three reasons. One, the chafing of our nylon outfits. Two, the chunking of our military-issue bunny boots on ice. And three, planes. Quote, if you're on foot and you choose to focus on the natural quality of the landscape, you're completely immersed in nature. Nothing else exists, unquote, Bechtel said. Quote, then a jet will go over and it kind of breaks that flow of consciousness, that ecstatic moment, unquote. Then Tingley traces a history of noise. In his influential 1977 work, The Tuning of the World, the Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer charts man's relationship with noise. As long ago as 3000 BC, he notes, the Epic of Gilgamesh discussed, quote, the uproar of mankind, unquote, which aggravated the god Enlil. Quote, sleep is no longer possible, unquote, he complains to the other gods. In the 2nd century AD, wagon traffic, quote, sufficient to wake the dead, unquote, ruined the Roman poet Juvenal's ability to rest between satires. Many English towns were sequestering their blacksmiths by the 13th century, and Bern, Switzerland passed its first law, quote, against singing and shouting in streets or houses on festival days, unquote, in 1628. Over the next 300 years, it also legislated against barking dogs, singing at Christmas and New Year's parties, carpet beating, and noisy children. In 1972, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency declared noise a pollutant. You can read that full story in the New York Times. And we want to take a look and a listen to all sorts of silence tonight. First, we'll listen to John Cage talk about silence a little bit, and then Zach Poff will explain his radio silence piece that was a piece with Free 103.9 several years back. So we're going to listen to a lot of silence on Turn on the News tonight. Here's John Cage.
The sound experience, which I prefer to all others, is the experience of silence. And the silence almost everywhere in the world now is traffic. If you listen to Beethoven or to Mozart, you see that they're always the same. But if you listen to traffic, you see it's always different.
Like an MVP and a VIP too.
And she's going to commit to nothing.
Only 30%. An alcoholic is always going to quit when
cooking, dinosaurs.
And then tomorrow,
among some of his many interests.
And of course, tomorrow never comes. Now, there are two ways
3110. Mario's calling from Maryland, on line 4. Mario, welcome to JSEC Yo Live.
Years of experience, of which he has minimal.
Thanks, Mario.
Assured Guarantee is the global leader in bond insurance.
Oh, you must vote no.
You know, I'm very curious about finding things out.
Legal immigrant.
The Sears Automotive Center knows that when you get your car back from the shop, you don't want to feel like you've been taken for a ride. That's why the Sears Blue Automotive Crew offers
to come to this country.
And that's true across all the different things that
so
I do.
So you start with a question.
Yeah.
You know, right? Because you want to know something and...
They're just hard-working people.
That certainly are incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, so when I was a physicist, I was interested in the question of where did space and time come from?
Right.
How did the universe begin?
The air ain't working. You know what I'm saying?
My interest in radio goes all the way back to listening to shortwave broadcasts when I was a kid.
It's really complicated stuff because...
If you love wealth greater than liberty...
I really...
It kind of happened in a haphazard way, so it's harder...
Go home from us in peace.
My dad was a member of a national amateur radio group that would find surplus military hardware and kind of apportion it. It was a federal program to give away these like old naval radios and things to kind of hacker clubs who would, you know, rewire them and fix them up and use them for stuff.
The real democratic American idea is not that every man shall be on a level with every other, but that everyone shall have liberty without hindrance.
Go about it in a Santa Claus approach.
So I actually, when I was really young, was like using this giant old tubed, 200-pound naval receiver and listening to all these crazy shortwave stations from all over the world. And the incredible sense of being afloat in this sea of noise that also had the potential to have signal in it was fascinating to me.
Can I give you my suggestion, Steve?
He will join us.
Is two back. It's the final in Detroit. The Tigers beat the Orioles 12-9.
Since that world is invisible, it's incredibly malleable. It's as though the world of radio has no specific body, so it gives us license to turn it into whatever bodies we choose. This project is Radio Silence, and it's a continuation of a bunch of stuff that I've been doing for the last couple of years, where I take little bits of live broadcast, sometimes it's TV, sometimes it's radio, and exploit the silences between words to figure out moments when we can cut from one track to another track.
Second stage of the Tour de France.
They have stepped up.
Before!
Ladies and gentlemen.
Now, it cost you only your commitment to sign up. To join Michael...
Once said she hopes that Clarence Thomas's wife feeds him lots of bacon and eggs.
That's the news you need now more than ever. I'm Catherine Cowdery, Bloomberg Radio.
So, in the case of Radio Silence, I'm taking these 8 AM radio receivers, and each receiver is feeding its signal to a different channel of computer software. The software that I'm making will listen for these pauses, and if the pause seems like it's a pause between clauses, maybe, instead of between words, if it seems long enough to be a significant break in the conversation, then we look around for all the other 7 channels, and we see if any of those channels are also pausing. So if they are, then we cross-cut the two.
Understand.
But also a Brooklyn psychic.
After escaping to the freedom of the West.
So tell me where we are.
To get out of that grip of fear. In fact, I remember one time...
AccuQuote can help you save up to 70% on a term life policy that's right for you.
And part of this piece is not only that we cut from channel to channel to channel and hear one kind of moving track of voice, but all of the other 7 channels who aren't speaking right now are speaking only their negative space. You hear one person talking at a time, kind of like zapping over from speaker to speaker to speaker, but there's this background noise, which is just a little like...
Shh, 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 shh.
I've been doing these things that are very based on speech and how language is changed in a kind of rhetorical model. And when I approached the idea of radio silence, I was actually less interested in the content of the speech and more interested in what I could discover about the talker by listening only to the pauses. The potential of those silences, when used in a context where you actually can hear the words, continues to be a really powerful thing. And in that sense, when we're listening to speech and when we're trying to understand the messages that someone's giving us, those pauses are obviously incredibly important, but they're not important in spite of the language, the words. They're important because of those words.
Disaster.
The warfare, really the...
And yet, they want to pass the most onerous gun restrictions under the notion that you can secure
30 weeks
against the importation of guns, or...
Kobe didn't help deliver.
They don't have to pay the wages.
A championship was delivered to Kobe.
Foreign invaders. Now, isn't that absurd?
And his psychiatrist.
He was barred from the contest because of a contract dispute.
These states...
But...
Until they take your guns away.
My process of taking apart these conversations and combining them is both an attempt for me to leave behind the idea that there is only one point of view, that there is only one conversation to be had, and at the same time is just kind of a grand experiment in seeing what a survey of the airwaves would lead to. And so I really like the idea that this conversation can be short-circuited, and that if there are 20 different conversations happening in parallel across this spectrum of broadcasters, we can sort of glue them together in a way that, is, in a formal sense, is relatively seamless, which is why the silent moments between the words become full of potential. Pauses between speech are a relatively democratizing device. No particular ideology, according to my actual research on this in the last couple of months, has more or less of an advantage. You know, unless you're playing music behind your signal, my system will essentially catch your speech no matter whether you're on the certain side of any political issue. So in a way, it's my attempt to really remove myself and my own listening habits from this process and develop a new way of listening, which incorporates small, contextless bits of the whole spectrum of broadcast, which is actually associated for me with a whole different kind of long-term project in my own artwork, which is to look at how the idea of broadcasting, the idea of one transmitter and many simultaneous receivers, is still alive and is still driving a lot of the conversations that we have in this very peer-to-peer, digitally networked world that we're in.
Discount all our progress at every turn because of what happened in the early history of this country.
But the, what we really have to wait for...
Because everybody's talking jets.
Okay.
My second comment was that I think they have to lose the case, Obama has to lose the case about the Arizona border issue, because...
Well, I'll tell you, the one guy from Alabama that he wanted went number 7 to the Raiders.
So personally, I think...
La minute de silence de
Christian Markley.
J'ai grandi, je suis et Et mais dans ce de 10 et
there is no such thing as silence.
Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research, a strategic and tactical methodology developed under military management in England during World War II. The original purpose of operations research was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. It was soon recognized by those in positions of power that the same methods might be useful for totally controlling a society. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its manner of functioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of a chemical reaction, originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder, from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnat instead of a military general. The silent weapon makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet, it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with daily social life, i.e., unmistakable to a trained observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon, and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves. When a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts, adapts to its presence, and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great and they crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobilities of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. Repetition breeds suggestibility. Repetition breeds suggestibility. I am not suggestible. I am not open to suggestion. Repetition breeds suggestibility. I am not open to suggestion.
Right now behind us is Dichroix, new band. You hear the theremin going off there. It's a little radio art. And then Dichroix is a Brooklyn-based band that includes former Dust Dive frontman Brian Zimmerman and his radio samples and Darren Mickey on theremin. A Dichroix filter, a thin film filter or interference filter, is a very accurate color filter used to selectively pass light of a small range of colors while reflecting other colors. Used before a light source, a dichroic filter produces light that is perceived by humans to be highly saturated, intense in color. So This is iPod Suicide from Die Croix. Now we're going to hear Corporate Woods Perfume, which starts with some phone samples, and then Freebase the Febreze on Turn on the News.
Indian cream.